together. Invest in remarkable Indonesia.
Welcome back to a very special edition. Here we are at the Robinhood Investment Conference, and I am with the one and only Carl Icahn. Carl, let's start with interest rates. In this low interest rate environment, how do you see this? What implications does it mean for the economy?
Well, the Fed is really, in my opinion, holding the market up. I mean, we're long and we keep a big hedge on. Day like this, we make money. But it is concerning that, the Fed turned this market around here because it sort of let it be known that the Fed funds rate isn't going to be raised in March. So you have to be concerned. I am concerned about the high yield market. I think that's in a major bubble, but I won't say to short it tomorrow, even though we have a short position on it to some extent. But what we do is a very arcane kind of derivative where we do the CDS. We buy the CDS on it. I'm going to explain it on my Twitter account one of these days. I'm going to try to write something on it. It's really interesting what we do on that. But it would take you more than half an hour to get into what we do with these derivatives. It's really sane. We did this in 07. I did it in 07 because I was worried. It was like this in 07. And, you know, sometimes you hit big. And in 07 and 08, see, that's what happens in 08. On a couple of hundred million investment, believe it or not, we made $1.4 billion because the spread widens. And when it widens, you make a lot of money.
But does it worry you to be in the credit derivatives market in high yield at a time where there's a liquidity crunch? Can't everybody find the exit door?
No, that's why we're on the other side of it. In other words, if they can't find the door, we come out pretty good. We're out of the fire, so to speak. I really think it's a bubble, but I'm not going to tell you to get nervous today. I think with the Fed doing what they're doing, nobody can pick what the market's going to do tomorrow, next week, even next month, and maybe even 6 months. You know, there are too many variables for the human brain to do it. It's wasted occupation. A lot of people write these areas.
Special edition. Here we are at the Robinhood Investment Conference, and I am with the one and only Carl Icahn. Carl, let's start with interest rates. In this low interest rate environment, how do you see this? What implications does it mean for the economy?
Well, the Fed is really, in my opinion, holding the market up. I mean, we're long and we keep a big hedge on. Day like this, we make money. But it is concerning that, the Fed turn this market around here because it sort of let it be known that the Fed funds rate isn't going to be raised in March. So you have to be concerned. I am concerned about the high yield market. I think that's in a major bubble, but I won't say to short it tomorrow, even though we have a short position on it to some extent. But what we do is a very arcane kind of derivative where we do the CDS. We buy the CDS on it. I'm going to explain it on my Twitter account one of these days. I'm going to try to write something on it. It's really interesting what we do on that. But I it would take you more than a half an hour to get into what we do with these derivatives. It's really saying the credit spread is way too narrow. We did this in 07. I did it in 07 because I was worried. It was like this in 07, and, you know, sometimes you hit big, and in 07 and 08, see, that's what happens. In 08, on a couple of hundred million investment, believe it or not, we made $1.4 billion because the spread widens, and when it widens, you make a lot of money.
But does it worry you to be in the credit derivatives market in high yield at a time where there's a liquidity crunch? Can't everybody find the exit door?
No, that's why we're on the other side of it. In other words, if they can't find the door, we come out pretty good. We're out of the fire, so to speak. I really think it's a bubble, but I'm not going to tell you to get nervous today. I think with the Fed doing what they're doing, nobody can pick what the market's going to do tomorrow, next week, even next month, and maybe even 6 months. You know, there are too many variables for the human brain to do it. It's wasted occupation. A lot of people write these erudite papers on it, but it's very hard to. You could pick it on a long-term basis and be right. Or you could find a no-brainer. You know, this is what I look for. With the risk
you
rewards.
You look for a no-brainer?
The risk rewards major in your favor. I think there's a no-brainer. Long-term, the high-yield market isn't a bubble. But when it's going to burst, it costs you money. To do what I'm saying, it costs you money while you're waiting. So it's not for a lot of people.
So you mentioned 2007, 2008. You have been in the markets for decades. When you look back in history, if you assume that history repeats itself in terms of finance, is there a period in history, is it 08, is it 1982, is it 1972, that you could say, I've seen this market before, and here's when it happened?
08 was the only time, Stephanie, where I was really worried that the whole thing could bust open. That was the only time in my whole history that I was nervous. And I think the Fed did a great job in saving it. Bernanke did a great job in saving it. Now, though, I worry the Fed, you know, is giving the patient too much medicine and doesn't know how to stop the medicine. And so every time they start saying, we're pulling back, you're going to get less medicine, something happens to the patient. And the day's going to come when they can't keep doing it. They can't, you know, you keep the Fed rate at zero, but you can't do that forever, because you're going to start having consequences that you can't even think about.
Like what?
Oh, I can tell you 10 of them. And I'm sure the Fed has thought of this. I mean, for instance, sooner or later, you're just going to have rampant inflation, and you can't deal with it. Or it's going to stop working. The medicine stops working. You can't give the patient more medicine. You're at zero rate. The Fed funds rate is zero. So it really could happen. That you just, it doesn't work. The economy is looking okay now. It's looking all right. But you got to think about it. I'm not sure that even though you have unemployment that is coming down a little bit, look at the pay scale to the individual. Look at the wealth difference. You have a lot of problems even today. Being that said, I'm not saying that this market should be shorted. I'm not saying to, I mean, we have a big hedge on, but we're long. We, you know, that's what we do, you know.
What if you had outside money? What if you had to offer monthly, weekly, daily liquidity? Could you survive in a market like this, or do you think we're going to see guys go down and we'll see real consolidation?
I'll tell you, if you have to offer that, I don't believe you can be an activist. I think it's very difficult to be an activist. With it being an activist, you have to have staying power and patience. And I mean, look, we're very proud of our record. I mean, if you bought our stock in 2000, you're up annualized 22% a year. You know, we really did great. And for the last 5 years, it even did better. But we have our ups and downs during these periods. When we do what we do, there's going to be dips. And but to be an activist, you need tremendous staying power. So that's one of the reasons I stopped the fund, because after the 08 break, we were getting three-year money. Nobody wanted to give you 3 years. And we did all right for our people in the fund, but it just didn't work for us. And then we had so much capital of ourselves anyway. I mean, we have a
You've got
very
so much capital. Would you ever consider taking outside money at this point?
No, not in a fund. We might in certain instances. We've talked about it, where we want a lot of money to go after a big company. And then we would maybe, you know, people have approached me about this where, you know, we put in $3 billion or $4 billion and then we get another guy to put in $4 billion or something to that effect, or two guys, $4 billion apiece, and we put in $5 billion in a big one. But it's really not there at this time. The market's gone too high for that right now.
You mentioned the Fed back in 2008. I know you had dinner with Ben Bernanke last week. Do you feel like he saved the world?
Bernanke did a great job. I think now, I mean, he's out of there. And
is Janet Yellen doing a great job?
I think, but this is not my expertise. So, I mean, I'm just saying it as, you know, somebody who has a good feel for it, I think. That right now, and I think they might even agree, and I said it before, that there's going to be unintended consequences of what's happening. And if that happens, you have a real problem.
All right. I'm going to play a word association with you. I'm going to give you a name.
No, don't do that.
You're going to tell me. Tim Cook.
I think he's a great CEO. One of the best I've ever met, and I've met a lot of them. I think.
Why is he a great CEO? Because he listens to you?
Tim Cook. I don't think Tim listens to anybody. He listens to himself. Look, I had dinner with him. I met him once or twice. I watched him. And he is what Silicon Valley should have, not Mark Andreessen and Michael Dell. They're on one end of the continuum. They are really banal guys. They are pernicious to the system. Cook is on the other side of that. I mean, you take Mark Andreessen. I mean,
are you saying nanny, nanny, poo poo to Mark Andreessen right now? I gotcha.
No, I'm not saying that because I think Donahoe should have done it 3 years ago. Hey, he went in. Hey, boy. I mean, how does a guy get away with it? I mean, he said, you know, as he leaves, I think he told the New York Post, I'm very pleased with what I've accomplished at eBay. And sure, he's pleased. You'd be pleased, too, if you could steal $5 billion. He took away $5 billion from the shareholders, and he got away with it. Well, you might be pleased, too, right? If you could get $5 billion and get
away with
it.
All right, so Andreessen's out. You got your wish. You got the board seats. Now what do you think of eBay?
Now what do I think of who?
eBay.
You see, eBay is very interesting because I know it sounds strange, I sort of like Donahoe. I think Donahoe really wants to do a good job. He wants to enhance value, but he's made a lot of errors. And I think he might even admit it. I mean, look, he made an error keeping Andreessen, but that's not the major error. An error that was just made now, which I think is more telling than most people do, is he's out of the Apple ecosystem and Apple Pay. And if you look at Apple Pay, Apple's a behemoth. Apple is going to make Apple Pay work. You know what I'm talking about. You know,
Apple Pay is going to make Apple work?
No, you know Apple Pay?
Yes, of course.
You go in with the thing?
Yeah.
Apple Pay has a very good future to it. But you, if you really understand it, so they use Visa, they use MasterCard and a few others. They don't use PayPal. I think Donahoe was crazy to go and take bad ads about them. I think right now they should be involved with Apple Pay. Okay, that's one error that I think he made. But he's made other ones, so I'm very nervous that you're going into a very, very tough situation with eBay. It's like Motorola. It's analogous to Motorola. And few will deny that we were very instrumental in saving Motorola from going bankrupt. What we did was we got on the board and we got them to split it, or helped to get them to split it. We were influential. And I think if you ask some of the board members, they'll say that. And then we went in and got and then once they split it, we brought in the right guy. We got Greg Brown, who was the then CEO. It was difficult. I had to have five martinis with him to convince him to become co-CEO for 8 months, because that's the only way you could get Sanjay Ryan. We went through, I had, I'd say, 40 dinners in my apartment with the Motorola people. You know, Greg Brown didn't get along with Sanjay Ryan. Two cats in a bag. We had to have him sit there.
Two cats in a bag.
Yeah, and we had him in my apartment to make, you know, to get him along until we split it. And then we were really instrumental in getting that thing sold to Google, which was a great deal I mean, I'm not saying it was so bad for Google, but it was great for Motorola because I don't think Motorola could have made it because there's nobody could compete with the Android, Samsung, and with Apple. And that's what has come out of it. I think eBay is in that situation. They got a jewel in PayPal. It's a jewel. It controls the online merchants. Not controls them. They get along and they have a great thing going with the two of them. But that can't last forever. And now somebody would love to buy them, I would believe. And this is what they should be exploring. Okay, they waited too long to do the spinoff. Great thing to do, and they should keep moving on that. But they should also explore a sale. And a lot of people be naysayers. I mean, they're always, you know, saying, oh, you're wrong. You know, but over the years, look at our record, and look what we brought to the shareholders. So that's what I'll say.
Is this Silicon Valley euphoria, the money coming from the sky, pouring into the valley, making you feel, if you think high yield is a bubble, how about that whole thing?
Oh, you know, it's almost despicable what goes on. That you have at Silicon Valley, these guys are like the old alchemists. You know, they take this crap and they say they're making gold out of it. There are great companies that have been made. But these guys then, they're like the emperor's new clothes. They try to get this reputation. I'm talking about guys like Dell and Andreessen because I know them a little bit for, you know, this little, shall I say, altercation. They have, like I said on TV before, they screwed more people than Casanova. That's what they do, okay? And I mean, I'm not going to hold back on saying what I believe.
Then so, when you hear this disruptive innovators, does it just make you sick to your stomach?
Oh, you know what? These guys. Hey, you know what? I'm going to do a study. Stephanie. It'll be interesting. I thought of it today. I'm going to do a study of all the money I made for shareholders, you know, mm-hmm. and the companies I went into from the day I went in, and how much capital they made till the day I went out, okay? And we made billions. But you know what might be interesting? If you take Dell and Andreessen together and find out how much they cost shareholders. The shareholders, they weighed in. They went on the bill. I mean, he's the only guy that I never saw Glass Lewis say you should kick a guy off the board except for this guy, and then he never left. And then what gets you is the arrogance. You know, these guys live in glass houses. I was minding my own business with Dell, even though he actually, I believe, screwed the Dell shareholders tremendously because he wouldn't let anybody. They set it up. Let me just tell you, I won't get into it now, but maybe in the future I will. They set it up and in a way that nobody could make a bid. But these guys go around pounding their chests, you know. And I learned something at school once, you know. If you live in glass houses, you shouldn't throw stones, especially at a guy that don't mind throwing them back at you. And I, you know, Dell was off my radar screen, but no more, you know.
Oh, he's on it.
Yeah, he's on it now. I just think, it's not that I'm mad that they insult you. I'm mad at their arrogance of telling you. I mean, after they literally kill their shareholders and then pound themselves on the chest and say, look at the good guys we are.
All right, let's
talk
about
it. And now I tell you what Hewlett Packard shareholders got to worry about. They're worried about
that. Hewlett Packard?
Yeah, because see, Andreessen on the board of Hewlett Packard, I'm sure Dell is going to work his way about trying to make a deal with Hewlett Packard. And if these two guys are involved, God help the Hewlett Packard shareholders. That's my warning for what it's worth.
All right.
You heard it first.
All right, as long as we're talking glass houses, is Warren Buffett living in one?
Buffett's a different kind of person. I mean, Buffett has literally made a lot of money for shareholders. He really has. If you look at what he's done over the years, I don't agree with some of the stuff he does, but I think he's way too easy on some of these companies because our companies in this country have, and I said that to Larry Fink just at this thing, at the conference, that I think that we have a major trouble in this country, because I think many, 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 too many of our companies are badly run. They're run by mediocre CEOs and should be made accountable. And I believe that if we don't do this,
Well, should that,
that's my
Buffett?
Passion. My passion. I think Warren Buffett should do more of that.
Should Warren Buffett be considered?
But he's not in a glass house because he doesn't do it.
But should he be considered the Oracle of Omaha, you know, the great leader of industries, when the financial industry is less popular than it's ever been? The world despises banking, and they hold Warren Buffett on a pedestal. From your seat, where you interface with all of it, what do you think about that?
Well, look, I'm not here to defend Warren Buffett. I think he should have done a lot more and should do more about corporate governance, okay? But Warren Buffett has done, in other words, he hasn't screwed shareholders like some of these guys in Silicon Valley. They screwed him. I don't see him doing that. I think he's legitimately made money. I don't agree with the fact that in his position, he couldn't do more about that, but that's not his nature.
I mean,
I'm not going to start getting into a war with Warren Buffett. I mean, I think he's a smart guy, and I think he's done well for shareholders, and there are things I disagree with him on, but hey, I don't like to start wars, but if somebody wants to start it with me, especially guys like that, I was minding my own business. They started it. I mean, hey, there's something in me that likes that because I'm really looking forward to going at them. I'm sure they'll be having more to say about me after today. And I got to tell you, there's a part of me. My mother said I have some kind of warrior gene in me or something.
A warrior gene?
Well, some I saw on TV. She said I was a throwback to a 13th century warrior in the family. But I would rather fight corporations than these guys.
Yeah, but earlier you were saying how you use credit derivatives, for example, and Warren Buffett in the past has called them weapons of mass destruction. What does that mean for the industry?
It's different. You really don't confuse it. The some of the things that we're using, I don't think he's calling them that. I think he was more talking about in 08 or 09 about derivatives used in the housing bubble that really blew up the economy. I mean, and there you have to blame Wall Street for that. And there's no question that Wall Street, and I think most of them will admit it, they were fault. They oversold mortgage-backed securities.
MBS, but didn't Barney Frank and the U.S. government promote, and Fannie and Freddie promote everyone to say it's part of your birthright, it's part of the American dream, everyone should buy a home? Are investment banks solely to blame for people lying on their mortgage applications?
What are you talking about?
The housing
the
crisis.
The whole Wall Street housing crisis, there's a lot of blame to go around in it, right? In other words, you blame Wall Street for selling those. I mean, if you really understood those derivatives, they were weapons of mass destruction. They were crazy. And these guys were selling them, okay? So you can blame them. And you can blame Barney Frank for allowing it to go through if you want to. There was so much blame to go around. But I find it hard to say Warren Buffett's to blame for it. I mean, why would you say that?
I'm not saying Warren Buffett is to blame. No. I'm definitely not saying Warren Buffett is to blame. Does it concern you that we're seeing mortgage standards loosen up again, and we could be getting ourselves back into a 2005, 2006 when the party begins all over again?
There's a concern in that. I think if you really want to be concerned, I think a concern which might start this avalanche is high-yield securities. I think, just think about it, it's a no-brainer. It's more like Apple is a no-brainer to buy it. This is a no-brainer because why do you go in and why are you willing? And here the public doesn't understand it.
Well,
why
we're in a low-default environment. People were desperate for yield. Where else were they going to go?
Okay, I agree with you. But what happens when it breaks? You know, 10 years ago, you had maybe $19 billion or something in these funds. Today you have like, I don't even know what it is, $800 billion or $900 billion. Where is it going to go when the fire starts?
But why is it going to break? Corporations have more cash on their balance sheets than they ever have before. Why do we think it has to break? Because everything always does?
I mean, I guess the answer, which is simplistic and probably facetious, because it always does, right? I mean, I would tell you that I could give you reasons why it might break. And I told you one, that if you stop, if you can't go lower than zero at federal funds rate, if that stops working to make the economy better, people are going to start getting nervous.
Do you feel better about Wall Street today now that we're more regulated? We're living in a Volcker, Dodd-Frank world where the street isn't long billions of risk like we were in 08.
I think it is better than it was, but I'm not telling you it's any panacea. I am still telling you there are many problems on Wall Street. But I think it's a lot better than it was. I don't think you'll have the bust that you had in 08, but you could have a real bad bust sooner or later. But I'm not telling you next week or next month or 6 months. We own a lot of stocks, so I don't want to be here saying, oh, you know, the market's going to bust. I am saying, though, that there could be a break in the market. But I am telling you that one of the – I like to look – you know, after you do it as long as I do, your instincts almost take over and tell you when something's great.
What's great? And,
well, I just told you two of them.
Yes.
The Apple is great. There's a few others that you find here and there that's great. Shorty long-term, but it's not an easy thing to do the way I do it. I'm going to explain in Twitter. Doing the CDS derivative is great. And great because of risk-reward. But all these things don't mean you're going to win. It means that you got a great risk-reward ratio. The risk is much smaller than it should be. It's like... You know a fighter. Let's say you know a fight's going on. And you know there's one great fighter fighting like a has-been guy. And you know he's definitely going to win. And the odds should be 10 to 1, you know. And that is what the odds should be. And you walk in and they tell you it's 2 to 1 or even money. Well, you're going to bet a lot on that on the favorite. And that's what I call a no-brainer. So I think Apple was one. Hey, it certainly was one a year ago when we tweeted it. And I think it still is.
Can you believe that you are Carl Icahn and you're saying to me when we tweeted it? 3 years ago, did you think you'd be sitting here, so check my Twitter account. Isn't that a little crazy?
Very crazy. But I don't tweet them. My daughter does.
She
took over. She does it. She's right here. She's come to watch my thing. She's coming to the business, and she does all the tweeting. I just write them. And even then...
You can get it all out in 140 characters. Atlantic City. Winning trade? Atlantic City.
Yeah.
What do you think right now?
A lot of problems. I mean, we are in it. We went in... I mean, I'm getting a little flack on that one, but we went in to the Tropicana when nobody would touch it. About 2 or 3 years ago, when it was bankrupt, nobody would touch it. I put $80 million in, and we saved that, and it's doing pretty well. Taj Mahal is a much tougher story, and we come in. I didn't even want to put $100 million into it, but it's a complicated thing. But you can't have the union contracts that you have there because there's no money. The company is just out of money. They don't want to believe it. So it could either close down or we'll put $100 million in, but we can't put it in and just lose. It's losing, even if we put the money in, and even if you didn't pay interest, it's losing $7, $8 million a month. You just can't have it.
How do you feel about Hertz Global right now? Hertz.
The Hertz?
Mean anything?
You mean the rent-a-car?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but, you know, it's a little tough to talk about it because we've just got on the board. And I don't like talking about something we've just got on the board on. I mean, obviously, we bought it, and obviously, we're involved with it. And I think, like anything else, I hope we can help. And we've helped in the past on a lot of companies like this. But I'd rather not talk about anything that we've just got representation on.
Herbalife,
we're on the board also. Herbalife, I can only say this. I never sold a share. And maybe you're laughing at me on that because it went way up and it went way down. And now it's come back up a bit. But people don't believe this about me, but I really don't buy for the short term. You know, the stock price to me doesn't matter until you buy or you sell. And that's what you have to be thinking if you're a successful investor.
Well, in a true activist, what should his or her time horizon be in terms of getting involved, being invested?
Yeah, I mean, look, I agree with Larry on this. Some of the activists are too short-term oriented. I agree. We're not. I mean, you look at our portfolio. We've kept stocks for 20 years, maybe more. I bought ACF in the mid-80s. So if you look at us, we're not short-term oriented, but some are, and I don't think it's good. I think he's right on that. Unless there's a reason for that, you know. that, I mean, if the stock goes way up, doubles in value, maybe you sell it. Although we never sold Apple.
All right, before we go, we've been very U.S.-centric. Are you looking at all at the ECB right now? Last week, I know, when you had dinner with Ben Bernanke, other attendees walked out and said, I'm nervous about Europe. I don't think they can do whatever it takes. Are you paying attention? Are you worried? Because many investors
aren't worried. Well, at the risk of being immodest, one of our major positions is a short on the euro dollar. So I will say that we sort of guessed right on that. And I think Europe has major problems. I mean, we own companies there. Western Europe is really a problem.
What would you have done for a living if you started all over again?
Well, what do you mean? What would
any
you have
other
chosen?
Industry, any other industry, what would you have done if you were to start all over again?
I never really thought of it. I was a real good student in school. I went to a real tough high school. Somehow I got into Princeton, and I was a real good student. I got really into philosophy. You know, you read some of this pap these guys in Silicon Valley put out. You read it, you laugh at it, but because they're all trying to be great philosophers because they think they made some money.
Carl
just smart.
Icahn, the philosopher. Carl,
okay.
Thank you so much. The world, according to Carl, the guy should have been a philosopher. Thank you so much
Come
for
on.
Watching.
Come on, you got me on that.
Thank
Come
you
on.
So
much. Put that back on.
Thank you so much for watching. I'm signing off. Stephanie Ruhl from the Robinhood Investment Conference.
After 3 weeks of protest, then J.Crew chief Mickey Drexler talks about the art and science of retail, plus where J.Crew could have gone but did not. And finally, in company, there's a growth story behind the first bourbon distilled in the state of New York. Tuttletown Spirits goes from small to big. That's later on Money Clip. But first, let's take a look at the top stories this Tuesday. Sales of previously owned homes rose in September to the highest level in a year. It's another sign that residential real estate will be a tailwind for the U.S. economy. The National Association of Retailers says closings advanced 2.4%. And China's GDP rose 7.3% in the last quarter compared to a year ago. That is the slowest growth in more than 5 years, but it is better than estimates, and that may bolster the government's case for avoiding more stimulus measures.
When I wake up in the morning, we keep an eye on China because I think it is the engine for global growth, whether or not you believe the numbers or not. I think it is the largest credit bubble going on in the global right now and one of the largest in history.
Chinos also said he thinks China's growth cannot be sustained. European regulators have hit J.P. Morgan with a $92 million fine. The bank agreed to settle claims that it tried to rig the benchmark Swiss franc LIBOR. J.P. Morgan was also fined for colluding with Credit Suisse and UBS on interest rate derivatives. The head of one of the world's biggest oil companies has been killed in a plane crash in Moscow. Christophe de Margerie was CEO of France's Total. His plane hit a snowplow on the runway as it was taking off. Russian investigators say the snowplow's driver was drunk.
Christophe de Margerie devoted his life to the development of the company in France and in the world, and to its 100,000 employees. As he would wish, Total should continue to move forward.
Three crew members were also killed in the accident. De Margerie was 63 years old. And McDonald's can't seem to turn around those slumping sales. Third quarter profit dropped 30%. U.S. sales were down for the fourth straight quarter as McDonald's faces growing competition from rivals offering deals and new items. And those are today's top stories. Well, McDonald's is not the only classic American company facing its share of challenges. Yesterday, we told you about IBM's blues, the tech giant scrapping their 2015 forecast and warning that earnings will fall this year for the first time in more than a decade. Well, now you can add another U.S. household name to the list.
Coca-Cola, 1% global unit growth.
Yeah, that's not encouraging, is it? Adjusted EPS matches the consensus, but the headline here that we're paying attention to is Coca-Cola restructuring its North American manufacturing operations. It is basically refranchising most company-owned North American bottling by the end of 2017. It's global supply chain.
People don't want sugar in their drinks.
Think Americans just don't buy cans of Coke the way they used to, and both shareholders and analysts say it is time for a change. CEO Mukhtar Kent has now announced a $3 billion a year cost-cutting plan, but even that may not be enough.
One of the key things they announced today is that they're going to step up their cost-cutting efforts. PepsiCo has been a lot more aggressive in saying that they're going to cut $5 billion over the next 5 years to try to increase productivity and increase profitability. Coke has been slower to that. Muhtar Kent, the CEO of Coca-Cola, has been slower with that knife. He stepped that up now, saying that he'll get $3 billion in annual costs by 2019. So that should add some more cash potentially to shareholders, although there are questions about whether that'll just be plowed right back into the business, which right. one investor says would sort of be a waste, or whether that'll go back to shareholders.
The cost-cutting plan was not the only headline from the earnings report. Maybe the CEO has something else up his sleeve.
Muhtar Kent's going to be a lot more aggressive in laying out a plan to take some of these North American distribution bottlers off the books in North America and get those sold back off to independent bottlers. He's saying he'll do the majority of those by 2017. It had been looked at about 2020. So investors are going to be glad to see some more clarity there as well.
Investors, though, not glad today. Shares fell as much as 6.6%. They've fallen more than 8% since hitting an all-time high just 2 weeks ago. The stock record belies the challenge Coca-Cola has had to reinvent itself, a subject that recently graced the cover of Bloomberg Businessweek.
The problem is that Coca-Cola is right now on the wrong side of just about every consumer lifestyle brand. Coca-Cola itself is sugary. It contributes to what people think as weight gain, and it's just not seen as healthy. Coca-Cola regularly cites obesity and ingredient concerns as a big risk to its business.
Now, the reporter of that cover story sat down with executives who have been working to change Coca-Cola's ways. Claire Sudduth spoke to Betty Lou.
They've made some mistakes in the past, and they're ready to move forward. And they also are really trying to, you know, market this as a treat, which they hadn't before. We used to guzzle it as we would water, and they're really sort of saying we can't really do that anymore.
But as they say it's a treat, they still have to sell billions of cans and bottles of Coke around the world.
They do, but the
regular Coke.
Exactly. They do, and around the world they're doing pretty well. But in the U.S., their new tactic is the smaller sizes will cost a bit more per ounce. So their hope is that if more people drink it, but just in the smaller sizes, they'll be able to make more money.
So the trinity of blue chip stocks facing challenges, Coca-Cola, IBM, and McDonald's, the three Dow stocks are the only losers in today's industrial average. And still ahead on Money Clip, Apple knocking it out of the park with iPhone sales. We'll break down what else is behind the company's massive earnings beat. Plus, coming up next, we bring you investment insight from the Robinhood Investors Conference. Hear why giants like Jim Chanos, Paul Tudor Jones, and Barry Sternlicht are putting their money. Plus, fashion legend Oscar De La Renta dies at age 82. For 50 years, the designer helped dress first ladies and celebrities from Jackie Kennedy and Michelle Obama to Sarah Jessica Parker and Oprah Winfrey. Most recently, De La Renta designed the wedding dress worn by Alma'al Al-Madun, otherwise now known as Mrs. Clooney. Here he is in 2012 speaking about where he draws inspiration from.
To me, every single day is a learning process. And I seem that to be a good fashionist. I mean, it's not what I did, it's what I'm doing. You know, it's about now. And this is what counts for me.
De La Renta had been battling cancer for years and passed away at his home in Connecticut.
When everything's included, the kids get a vacation of their own. And so do we. But when we get together, it's the best time of all. I can feel you yeah. Right now, you can get up to 65% off. Call your travel agent or 1-800-BEACHES.
Sailing through the heart of cities and landscapes with Viking, you'll see things differently. You'll get closer to iconic landmarks, to local life and cultural treasures. It's a feeling that only a river can give you, that only Viking can give you. Spend less time getting there and more time being there. Viking River Cruises, exploring the world in comfort.
Thank you. occur. When both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success. Together, invest in remarkable Indonesia.
Hi, I'm Barry Sloan of Newtek, the Small Business Authority. As a small business owner, you know how difficult getting a bank loan can be. With a simple phone interview, we can pre-qualify you in 48 hours. That's why we're the nation's largest non-bank government-guaranteed lender. So whether you need $5 million or $50,000, you can count on Newtek, the Small Business Authority. Call us at 8552-THE-SBA or visit us at THESBA.com.
You take all your business calls yourself. Sort of makes it hard to look professional or get anything done. By helping to expertly manage your incoming calls, eVoice provides you with a better way to connect, regardless of whether you're a business of one or 100. We connect all incoming calls to eVoice instead of directly to you. So wherever you are, at home, the office, or on the road, you'll never miss a call. Get started with your 60-day free trial now at eVoice.com. Enter promo code TV60 and get the first 60 days free.
This is Money Clip on Bloomberg Television, streaming live everywhere online, on your phone or tablet, even Apple TV and Amazon Fire TV. I'm Olivia Stearns. Oh, to be in the room with the world's biggest investors. It is a privilege that many are paying $7,500 for. That's the ticket price to sit in on the Robinhood Investors Conference right here in New York, where top money managers are revealing exactly what they're doing with all their dough, or at least some of their dough. They do have a lot of it. Bloomberg's Stephanie Ruhle is there and spoke exclusively with hedge fund manager Jim Chanos, who you might remember called the housing bubble. Here he is talking about his next big trade.
I gave a presentation inside to the Robinhood folks on an idea we've been involved with on and off for the last couple of years, but was timely because of the upcoming election. This Sunday, the presidential election in Brazil is occurring, and Brazilian stocks have basically been ping pong balls, moving every which way based on where people think the presidential election will fall out. Our point was Petrobras is such a unique animal globally and as an energy stock that it defies that kind of simple analysis.
And why? I mean, it is so tied to Dilma Rousseff.
Well, it is, and that's the interesting thing. Every time Dilma's poll numbers go up, Petrobras stock goes down, and every time Nieves's numbers go up, Petrobras's stock goes up. The problem is, it is tied to Dilma. She was the chairwoman of this company. There's been a number of investigations and scandals swirling the company, around the company, and we're just not sure that even if Nieves wins, he's going to really be feeling all warm and fuzzy toward this creature. Having said all that, the economics are just so poor at Petrobras that we really have called it a scheme, not a stock.
A scheme. Do you believe they misled investors back in 2010 when they did the IPO?
Well, we did. There was a slide in our presentation where we looked at the company's projections. They keep these five-year plans that they keep revising. And suffice it to say that if you look on the table, they have been a tad too optimistic down through the years.
But is that enough to call it a scheme?
Well, no. The problem is that, in fact, the company is cash flowing about $25, $26 billion U.S., so-called EBITDA. And its CapEx annually is $45 billion and another $5 billion of capitalized interest. So their gross cash flow is only covering half of their capital spending and capitalized interest, so they're not covering their dividend. And in fact, they're having to borrow the shortfall. And they're borrowing more than $20 billion U.S. a year. This is an enormous, enormous sinkhole from a financial point of view.
So their expectation to double output by 2020, for you, laughable.
Well, they can double output by 2020. So the last handful of years, 5 years, production really hasn't increased. And we put a chart up, show the Robinhood folks, despite this enormous capital expenditures and the fact that their big pre-salt field is now coming online, production hasn't increased. And that's disturbing. Now, maybe it will double in the next 6 years, but we would argue it has to double to basically service all this new debt that they're taking on and will take on to complete the field. And, you know, in the oil and gas business, particularly in Brazil, as you know, sometimes things don't always turn out the way you think they're going to turn out. I think we can look at the Batista saga and others to really point out to you there are enormous risks here.
And Batista saga way too tied to the government. So are you saying this is just like that? Because many people think if Nevis wins, the stock will rally.
Well, that's in fact what I think will be the opportunity, and that's why I thought it was timely this week, that if that's what happens and if investors knee-jerk run into the Bovespa and buy Petrobras because Nevis wins, I think it's a great entry point on the short side in this story because it doesn't change the economics of this situation. And we pointed out today in our presentation that Even if you gave this company Exxon's margins, both upstream, and I see your eyebrows, and downstream, it would still be break-even cash flow.
All right, so Jim Chanos has a short strategy on Petrobras. Now on to real estate mogul Barry Sternlicht. He says gyrations in the stock market are making property investors feel pretty good.
You know, I always say for real estate, it's an interesting period because if rates stay lower longer, the yield in real estate is quite valuable. And if rates rise because of economic growth, which people thought the U.S. is growing and rates will rise again, then rents go up. And so we're living in a pretty good spot for the property markets right now.
When the ECB does an asset review of these European banks, are they going to be forced to start to sell these loan portfolios with these real estate assets that they've been sitting on that have basically been priced too high the last few years?
Absolutely. So about in the last $2 billion we've invested of equity capital, about 70% of it's gone to Europe. And you're seeing the banks all over the periphery, at least, sell assets and sell loans and begin to do what they didn't have to do 3 or 4 years ago, which is mark their loans to market. As long as they were paying, they could pretend they were at, you know, they weren't 100% loan to value. But some of these loans are so underwater. We just bought a deal in Spain. I think we paid like 30 cents on the loan dollar. They historically haven't been willing to take that kind of hit because it hit their equity capital. But today, because of the LTRO and all the other programs to support the banks and the fact that the review's coming, they are actively looking to unload assets. And many of us are spending a lot of time. We have 50 people in London right now. So we keep hiring, and we're very busy over there. I was just in Sweden and Norway last Thursday and Friday.
And you see this as a buying opportunity while Europe is bleeding and people are desperately trying to sell?
Well, there's a lot of capital, a lot of shark capital wants to be in Europe right now. Taken together, it's the largest economy in the world, and it's not going away. It's you got to figure out what to buy and where to buy it. We've just bought mostly in the periphery of Europe, the UK, Ireland, the Nordics, tiny bit in Spain and Eastern Europe.
You can watch a special interview with Carl Icahn today at 5:30 p.m. right here on Bloomberg Television. And if you're watching us at night, catch the interview on Bloomberg.com/TV. We'll also have more from the Robinhood Investors Conference ahead, including a conversation with J.Crew CEO Mickey Drexler. And Apple Pay is here. Does the mobile payment system live up to the hype? I decided to check it out for myself.
Perceptions change and evolve. In a recent Bloomberg Audience Insights report, more and more IT decision makers evaluated Android as a secure platform for large-scale business operations. In the survey, 72% of IT decision makers said they had deployed an Android device as part of a bring-your-own-device initiative. Among them, more than 9 in 10 had deployed an Android device from Samsung. One reason they trust Samsung Android devices is the Knox security platform. 79% believe Knox is extremely or very useful for application security, with 78% mirroring that sentiment for malware protection. Samsung is in the unique position to offer security that is deeply rooted in hardware and constantly moves forward to help business realize the full potential of mobility.
What makes a good business a great one? Capital. Larry King for LendVantage, a free service that connects small business to big capital and can help your business get from $5,000 to $250,000. Go online, complete a simple application, and you could get pre-approved for up to $250,000 in minutes. And you can get the money in as fast as one business day after approval. Go to LendVantage.com or call 1-800-999-LEND.
We're at a place in our lives where we need investment income. That's why we invest in tax-free municipal bonds.
We love the income they provide us, income that's federally tax-free. And at this point in our lives, tax-free income is exactly what we need.
Tax-free municipal bonds can serve as the cornerstone for a conservative portfolio. They offer income that's tax-free. Henning and Walsh is a leading expert in tax-free municipal bonds, committed to finding you the best bonds to meet your investment goals. We'll even send you our informative bond guide absolutely free if you call right now. 1-800-895-7895. If you have at least $10,000 to invest, consider municipal bonds. They provide income that's federally tax-free. Take charge of your investments today. Call now to receive your free copy of our informative bond guide. It's free, so call now. 1-800-895-7895. That's 1-800-895-7895.
TA25 from the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange, powering the Israeli economy. Find more information at www.ta25.co.il.
In tech, Apple crushed its quarterly earnings report yesterday after the bell, in very, very large part, that was thanks to the iPhone. They sold more than 39 million of them. That is a 16% gain from a year ago.
So you've got a 12% year-over-year gain in the biggest company out there in terms of market cap on earnings per share because of the share buyback, aided by the share buyback. Not only were revenues up 12%, earnings per share were up even more at 20%. So very strong gains for this company that's already that big, as I'm looking at the results literally as they're crossing right now. $42.1 billion, quarterly profit of $8.5 billion. So if I pump that into my model really fast, I promise it'll be worth it, thanks to our good friends Excel. So this company, as fast as revenues are growing at 12%, profits, not adjusted, actual profits, growing at 13%. So this is a business on a year-over-year basis that's just growing and getting more and more profitable.
For more insight on Apple's latest earnings, let's hear from Techonomy CEO and Bloomberg contributing editor David Kirkpatrick. He joined Betty Lou this morning on In the Loop. Here are his takeaways.
I think what's happening as the success of the iPhone just grows and grows and the reflected glow on the entire company increases, everybody starts thinking this is the company with the best product, period. People who've been using Windows are increasingly saying, you know what, I'm going to dump it and move to a Mac. They're so much more beautiful. They're more beautiful to use. All your cool friends have them. I think it's been happening. But if Mac sales are up 21% this quarter, that says something new. They're broken out of a range they've been in, and I think it's a very big deal. I think that could be the growth business for Apple that people aren't paying attention to.
Really? The growth business?
Yeah.
Not the iPhone?
Look, do you know how many PCs are sold? Do you know how many PCs are sold every year? It's hundreds of millions. I mean, they could really, if they took a bigger share of that, it's still a gigantic.
But it's not the sexy part.
It's not sexy at all. But it's very high
Apple.
Margin and very high price.
And you're skeptical about Apple Pay, is that right?
I'm really, there's so many things that are hard to judge in advance right now. The world is changing so quickly, as Ginni Rometty of IBM just found out.
You know, right.
I mean, honestly, I'm confused. There have been so many efforts to try to do contactless payment. All the credit card companies have tried it. Google's been trying it for a while. It may be that Apple's extraordinary brand, just like it's conferring this glow on their PCs, their Macs, may actually do something for payments that nobody else could do. And I hope it's true. I would love to see payments get easier. We all would benefit.
So Apple is proudly claiming that Apple Pay is already in place in over 220,000 stores. But are all of those partners really ready to roll? I hit the streets of New York to find out. Apple says my new iPhone 6 is going to completely replace my wallet. So I've decided to put Apple Pay to the test. Let's go see how much shopping I can get done. My first stop, the Disney Store. Looks like I might not actually need a wallet, but that doesn't mean I don't need a handbag. I think we've got a winner. So that took a little bit longer than I expected. Interestingly, Apple Pay did not work as my Visa debit card. It did work when it read my card as a credit card. Either way, I did have to sign, but I'm still 2 for 2. It's called Olivia's. A $35 ostrich egg. So here's the deal. Apple Pay works very well. It works so smoothly, in fact, that it's a little bit anticlimactic. I even got a little carried away a few times and had to return some things like the ostrich egg, and that too went very smoothly. The most impressive part so far is that Apple Pay does save transaction time. And for stores like Whole Foods that are mobbed during rush hour, anything you can do to move customers through a little bit more quickly is going to mean a lot more business. All right, just one more stop. After all of this shopping, my feet are killing me. I need to get some aspirin. All right, that's everything. I am out of money and I am out of time. All I need to do now is get home, and for that, I'm going to Uber. Hi, do you take Apple Pay?
I have no idea.
No?
Yep.
I can't get it to work. Well, at least Uber already has my credit card.
That's right.
Now, in fairness, Uber did put out a software update to enable Apple Pay late yesterday afternoon, but I had already hit the road, and who wants to do a software update when you don't have Wi-Fi? I will, though, let you know tomorrow if it actually works. As protesters watch the much-awaited talks between student leaders and government officials in Hong Kong, we take a look at how the three-week movement is affecting local businesses. That's coming up in World. And Tuttletown Spirits brings bourbon to New York, a first for craft distilleries in this week's Small to Big.
Housewares products from Thailand can be found in all corners of the globe today. They reflect well on the high levels of thought, designs, and skills that were put into creating these distinctive items. Thai houseware products are trusted worldwide and have been proven to be among the world's best in quality. Think design and quality. Think Thailand.
This fax just got Nick the funding for his startup. This fax just got Kim's clients their dream home. And this fax just won Tom his biggest case ever. That's the power of eFax. It's as easy as email. Simply snap a photo of a document and fax it. Even sign your name. And now try eFax free for 30 days. Go to eFaxTV.com and start your free trial. Fax it online, on time, wherever you are, with eFax.
I am so glad that Jen set us up.
Yeah.
So how do you guys know each other?
Jen and I went to summer camp together.
Oh, that's cute. Yeah.
You know, I never lost a Maccabi.
Oh, whoa.
I know,
watch
right?
out. What's Maccabi?
Oh, man. I am tired.
You know, I never lost a Maccabi.
Color Wars?
You know what that is?
Yeah, we call it Maccabi, too.
Do you want to go out and grab a drink?
Yes. Do you want to meet my parents?
Nailed it.
You're right. That was really easy. I know. I told you so.
On Progressive.com, you can compare our Progressive Direct rates with our competitors' rates. So shopping is easy.
You don't sound like Flo.
Yeah, I do.
Who are you talking to?
What?
What's on your hand?
My wedding ring. Symbol of our love.